Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled ICE to Meet You, Greenland, U.S. Acquisition Attempts. Our moderator today is Nitin Nainani. Nitin is a judicial law clerk at the Southern District of Florida. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Nitin, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Caroline. And to everyone joining us this morning, welcome. I'm excited to moderate today's conversation, which is a timely one in light of President Trump's statements about acquiring Greenland. My hope is that audience members will leave today's discussion with greater context about historical attempts to acquire Greenland, the strategic and economic interests driving this consideration, and the complex legal and sovereignty issues involved. Now, before I introduce our distinguished guests and get things going, I want to reiterate that audience members, you're encouraged to leave questions in the Q&A box. If your question lines up with ones I'm asking, I'll try and find ways to incorporate it. But if not, we'll try to get to it at the end of the program. Now, without further ado, I'm honored to introduce today's guest, Dr. Roman Shufford and Mr. Alexander Grain. Dr. Shufford is the president and managing director of the Arctic Institute. He co-hosts the Arctic Institute's Bookshelf podcast and serves as the project manager for various projects done in partnership with the Fridtjof Nansen Institute. Dr. Shufford's research interests include human rights and the rights of indigenous people, Arctic cooperation and ocean governance, and international environmental law. He is the current Nansen Professor in Arctic Studies at the University of Akureyri, Iceland, and holds both a PhD in law and an MA in polar law from Durham University in the UK and the University of Akureyri, Iceland, respectively. Alexander Gray is a senior fellow in national securities affairs at the American Foreign Policy Council. His work focuses on U.S. security and defense strategy in the Indo-Pacific, U.S.-China competition globally, and especially in the Pacific Islands and polar regions, U.S. defense strategy and modernization for great power competition, and the intersection of U.S. national and economic security. Mr. Gray served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Chief of Staff of the National Security Council at the White House, and before that, as Special Assistant to the President for the Defense Industrial Base at the White House National Economic Council. Mr. Gray's writings have appeared in a number of publications, including Foreign Policy, The National Interest, and Strategic Studies Quarterly. He is a graduate of the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Dr. Shufford, Mr. Gray, thank you both for joining us today. So I want to set the scene a little bit with our first question, and I'll start with you, Dr. Shufford. Could you explain to our audience what exactly is Greenland's current political status and the nature of its relationship with Denmark?
Thank you so much for having me. And apologies in advance, as I think this question requires a very granular answer, which may end up being, as it may, quite a long answer. So to understand Greenland's constitutional position inside the Kingdom of Denmark, we must go back to the aftermath of World War II, and especially one key date in 1946. The United Nations required the then colonial powers to list their colonial possessions on a list of non-self-governing territories in conformity with Article 73 of the UN Charter. States needed to transmit annual reports to the UN on the political, economic, and social advancements of the people concerned. Greenland was, in 1946, Greenland was listed as a non-self-governing territory. But to speak plainly, really, Copenhagen didn't really like the idea of being regarded as a colonial power. And to avoid having to list its colonial possessions, in Greenland included, Denmark chose to revise its constitution and parliamentary architecture. So in 1953, Greenland was therefore formally integrated into the Kingdom of Denmark through the Constitutional Act of the 5th of June 1953, and was granted 2 seats in the Folketing, the Danish parliament. This constitutional redesignation allowed Denmark in September 1953 to notify the UN Secretary General, and they would cease to transmit the annual progress report under the general resolution I spoke about. And in effect, the amendment turned Greenland into a co-equal component of the Danish state or the Kingdom of Denmark, and Copenhagen managed really to avoid the, let's put it generously, the mounting normative pressure through, for example, the UN Resolution 1514 of 1960, so the Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples, that really called the end of colonial empires. Then after 1953, Greenland gained more statutory autonomy through the Home Rule Act of 1979, which established the Greenland Parliament and transferred some competences from Copenhagen to Nuuk. And then from 1979 to 2009, we have the Self-Governed Act that replaces the 1979 regime. Through the 2000 Act, or the 2009 Act rather, did 3 things. First, it recognized in Danish law and Greenlandic law that the people of Greenland had the right to self-determination, a right that it had under international law since the 1960s. Two, it really enlarged the list of devolved competences from Copenhagen to Greenland. And three, it created a catalogue mechanism by which Nuuk may assume additional competences unilaterally, with, in this case, Danish consent being limited to ensuring continuity of kingdom-level obligations. So under the 2009 Act, Copenhagen retains, for example, foreign affairs, defense, security, intelligence, citizenship, monetary policy, and Supreme Court-level administration of justice, to translate it in a way that makes sense to our audience today. And Nuuk, on the other hand, has virtually all the other legislative and executive functions. So management of natural resources, which has been a big thing in developing the 2009 Self-Government Act, taxation, external trade, etc. And then this allows for some kind of fiscal architecture to be in place between Copenhagen and Nuuk, that a block grant is of approximately $600 million is being sent from Copenhagen to Nuuk every year, which is around 20% of GDP and more than half of Greenland's public budget. And then in terms of external relations and treaty practice, Copenhagen speaks in what we call in kingdom matters, so foreign policy and security, as I said. But under the 2009 Act, especially Section 12 and Section 13, Greenlandic ministers are authorized to negotiate and conclude treaties in fully devolved subject areas, provided that those agreements do not alter Denmark's own international legal obligations. So we have really this internally self-governing under the Danish kingdom, also endowed with an explicit statutory option for external self-determination.
Thank you very much. And I'd now like to turn to Mr. Gray with my next question. So where has Greenland then historically fit into America's strategic calculus? And what sort of historical role has the U.S. played in Greenland, particularly during World War II and the Cold War?
Yeah, well, I very much appreciate the chance to be here. As someone who comes from a long family of lawyers but did not go to law school, I can now say, I may not have gone to law school, but I've talked to the Federalist Society. So I've got that going for me now. So look, I think one of the confusions in the public domain is that this is a Donald Trump kind of vanity project. That is not the case. And looking at the historical record, there is a long, deep tradition in American strategic thought of viewing Greenland as essential to our core security interests. If you go back to the 1860s, 1867 to be exact, William Seward, who was President Lincoln and President Johnson's Secretary of State, made an attempt to purchase Greenland, to acquire Greenland. And that was animated by the very same, and you know, I've had the opportunity to go back and look at some of the archival material, and it was the same kind of motivation, the same concern that great powers, in that instance, European great powers, but over time, obviously, it's evolved, would use a situation where Greenland did not have was not in the American sphere of influence to use Greenland as a staging base to threaten the United States directly, or to threaten core American interests in the hemisphere. And that sense of Greenland kind of as a dagger potentially pointed at the heart of the continent and the American homeland continued throughout the 20th century. And President Wilson during World War I had very detailed conversations about an acquisition. It continued under President Roosevelt. It continued under President Truman. It continued under President Eisenhower. Most notably, as you mentioned, in World War II, when Denmark was occupied by the Nazis, the United States actually did occupy Greenland militarily with the very clear goal. And if you go back and you look at the diary of Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of War at the time, very much with the concern that if the Nazis were to acquire Greenland, they would use it as a U-boat base or potentially even as a bomber base to directly target the United States. And you notice, if you look at President Roosevelt's fireside chats, he makes many references to bases that could be used to target for enemy bombers to target the East Coast of the United States. And Greenland was very much one of the things that was in mind. And this continues throughout the Cold War. And it's a little different, but in the Cold War, and this is what led to the treaty in the 50s between the U.S. and Denmark to establish a permanent U.S. presence there and to have a mechanism for U.S.-Danish military cooperation in Greenland. The primary motivating concern for the U.S. during the Cold War was that the gap that separates the maritime gap, it's called the GI-UK gap, the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap, the body of water that separates Iceland, Greenland, and the UK, was where Soviet submarines in Murmansk would come down through that gap and threaten the east coast of the United States. The thinking there was, and the U.S. Used Greenland extensively during that period to help monitor those submarine movements. I think the point here in recounting all this history is that while the names of the countries and the leaders change, the core American strategic concern with Greenland potentially being a mechanism for threatening our security interests, that is unchanged. Whether it's 1867 or 2025, the concerns remain very similar. And I think that's what it's important for us to understand as we evaluate the proposals and the interest that has been renewed in Washington.
So I want to stay with you for my next question then. And, you know, you just mentioned that, you know, there have been longstanding strategic concerns. What would you then say are the sort of critical strategic interests that underlie the president's talk about acquisition now? Or, you know, is it for him just the fact that Greenland is a large piece of real estate on a map?
Well, I think... the way, as someone who worked in the White House on the National Security Council when this first came up in 2018, I can tell you that the concerns that were raised at the time really came from concerns about what do malign actors like China and Russia intend to do in Greenland, and what could they do in Greenland if there was a security situation that was not to the benefit of the United States. My personal view, speaking obviously only for myself, myself, is that as long as Denmark, as long as Greenland is a constituent part of the Kingdom of Denmark, we have relatively limited security concerns. Yes, we can do more to encourage Denmark to provide resources for Arctic defense. Yes, we can do more to put resources under the treaty from the 1951, I believe. Yes, we can do more to put, you know, to exercise our authorities there and to have a greater American presence in Greenland. I think all of that is true. The concern, I think, the fundamental concern is that in an environment where Greenland has increasing autonomy, as the doctor laid out, and as Greenland is moving, you know, if you take their national security strategy that the Greenlandic government put out last year at face value, if they're headed towards independence, the fundamental American concern is an independent Greenland without the anchor of the Kingdom of Denmark from a security standpoint is going to be exceptionally vulnerable to Chinese and Russian malign activity. And we've seen this playbook across the Pacific, Africa, the Western Hemisphere. The fundamental concern the Americans have is that without a mechanism to maintain, from an American standpoint, a secure operating environment in Greenland, very likely we are going to see Greenlandic sovereignty compromised in a way that would have concomitant negative impacts on American security. What I think most about is, you know, the Chinese in the Solomon Islands are a great example, where the Chinese come in economically, they follow it with law enforcement. Next thing you know, they're trying to get access for visiting troop rotations and ship visits and airfield acquisitions. Greenland's even smaller than that, 50 something thousand people, one of the second least densely populated place on Earth. I think there is a huge opportunity for bad actors to exploit Greenland's large size, small population, a developing status, to do things that would undermine U.S. and broader Western security interests if we don't have a mechanism in place to make sure that that doesn't happen.
I just want to give you a chance to weigh in on this, Dr. Shepherd, if you had any thoughts on Greenland's strategic kind of importance to the United States in this current moment.
I think I agree with Mr. Gray, but I would qualify the answer by saying I think we also need to look at a map of the Arctic, and the geostrategic importance of Greenland is obviously quite important, especially in this moment and of time. I think what we also need to perhaps not overblow too much is the capacity of Greenland to become independent, obviously through the Self-Government Act of 2009. As I said, Greenland has a clear pathway to independence. Independence in this sense can also mean choosing your allies and choosing to enter into treaties with potential allies as well. So, for example, Greenland could join NATO and be still under the NATO umbrella as a fully autonomous state. So I think I don't think we need to pitch Greenlandic independence against geostrategic concern here. I think Greenlandic independence can be achieved in a way that also fits into its potential allies or its future allies and current allies agenda as well.
If I could, I would just say to that doctor, obviously we want to find a way in a theoretical post independence grins area to integrate Greenland. I would just say on the NATO front, I think it's going to be very difficult, you know, having worked extensively with NATO, to get at the most basic level, to get agreement by all the NATO states for accession, and two, for Greenland to meet the 2% or growing threshold for GDP spent on defense. So I think there are some institutional challenges for NATO accession that have led me to think that we might need to look for other mechanisms to integrate Greenland into that security.
So I'm, you know, glad that we're kind of having this conversation about, you know, some challenges, you know, in terms of proposals moving forward. One obstacle I'd like to talk about, you know, is public opinion in Greenland. If you look at, you know, a recent poll that was taken in January, 85% of Greenlanders do not support joining the United States. Moreover, it was reported that, you know, the president had a very contentious call with the Danish prime minister, in large part because of this issue. So I'll start with Dr. Shufford. Could you kind of lay out to our audience, why has the reaction been so poor in Greenland and Denmark on this particular issue? What kind of explains public opinion, and what sort of, you know, obstacles is, you know, kind of the Denmark government's, you know, opposition kind of provide here?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a very good question. And I think perhaps the reaction, or the overwhelmingly negative reaction, was, I think, mostly due to the language around acquisition, a term that did not really sit well with either Greenland or Copenhagen in this sense. I think we need to see this as almost a step-by-step answer that finds its answer in the independence process of Greenland as well. As someone working with law, I have to go back to the Self-Government Act. But in the Self-Government Act, you have, as I said, this clear pathway towards independence that would be achieved through a Greenlandic referendum. And I think at the moment, public opinion, and generally when we speak about independence, is about independence from Denmark and gaining independence. The language around acquisition in this case, whether it's buying or acquisition by force, was suggested at some point, which I don't think it is suggested at the moment, was really removing and objectifying Greenland in a way that didn't really sit well with Copenhagen, as Copenhagen still sees very much Greenland as part of the Kingdom of Denmark, which it is, and with Greenlanders who also view independence and the question of independence, whether they are for or against, as key to a statecraft in Greenland as well. So I think it's really the language around acquisition. If the language had been different, if partnership had been proposed or agreement, I think this would have sit a bit better in this sense.
My next question is for Mr. Gray. And just, you know, again, looking at obstacles to the president's proposal, whether political or practical, one obstacle has been the repeated kind of message that Greenland is not for sale. How do you sort of respond to kind of that that statement?
Yeah, look, I think there's, if you look at the current moment, like the doctor was referring to, there's kind of antibodies have now built into the system in Greenland that have, you see this in just a couple of months, and the results of the recent election are certainly testament to it. You know, I would go back, look from a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, at the foreign defense security strategy that the Greenlandic government put out, which basically it says we want to be on a path to independence and we want to have all these capabilities that would make us successful as an independent state, and with a 2030s timeline, kind of both clear but also ambiguous. And that's certainly not the rhetoric that's coming out right now. And I think it's clearly a reaction to, you know, how they're perceiving language coming out of Washington. That all being said, you know, this is, as we've demonstrated, I think, the U.S. concerns are 160 years old and are not going anywhere. This is about geography. It's not about presidents or prime ministers. This is about fundamental geography and security interests. And so the question really is, over the long term, how do we build proposals and relationships will allow us to solve for our concerns, while also, I think, offering something positive to the Greenlanders. This, you know, one of the things that gets lost in this conversation is that this can't just be about solving a security dilemma for the United States without taking into account concerns that the Greenlanders have, whether that's on the economic development side, whether that's on the sovereignty side. I mean, part of the American message here needs to be what we we are trying to solve for in terms of our security is also about protecting the sovereignty of the people of Greenland, because the malign actors that we are concerned about have a terrible track record of respecting sovereignty. So these things are not mutually exclusive. And to the extent the messaging from the United States can be about aligning our security interests with respecting sovereignty and indigenous rights and economic opportunity, I think we can start building a more fulsome dialogue for the next 10, 20, 30 years. Because my contention, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert on Greenlandic politics and you know, the way that the doctor is. But one thing I would say is I get the sense from talking to people in Greenland that there will be increasing autonomy. The trajectory is to have increasing autonomy. This moment in time may have changed the dynamics for a while, but the long-term trajectory is to independence. And so that's why we need to have this conversation now about building those options and that optionality so we can offer something constructive in the years ahead.
So I want to jump to Dr. Shufford for my next question. We've talked a little bit about this sort of public opinion in Greenland and, you know, getting buy-in from Greenlanders themselves. Why does that matter in the context of international law?
That's a great question. I think it really matters in terms of acceding to external self-determination in this context. As I said, the power that is clearly laid down in the Self-Government Act to independence relies on two things. First, that the Parliament of Greenland would need to trigger a referendum, so a vote around independence. And then to exercise their right under international law to external self-determination, Copenhagen, in that sense, would have to clear through a legislative process the outcome of the referendum. So Copenhagen cannot stop in this sense the referendum process or the outcome of the referendum process if the Greenlandic government chooses to act on the outcome of the referendum, which my understanding is that the Greenlandic government would be legally bound by the Self-Government Act provisions to do so. But at the core of that, we really have this principle of right to external self-determination. So the right to become a state of your own under international law. And that's really why then when we think of public opinion, the public opinion that will carry the referendum through whenever this referendum arrives or is triggered by the government will have an influence on the exercise of the right to external self-determination in this context. So we have a clear link here between public opinion and Greenland's exercises of its rights under international law.
Now, I want to give both of you a chance to talk about your very different proposals for greater American engagement with Greenland. You've both written extensively and, you know, given different presentations on, you know, this. But starting with Mr. Gray, I'd like to give you both a chance to present what your proposals are.
Sure. So look, I think that the simplest from an American perspective, the simplest way to do this is obviously for Greenland to become an insular area of the United States, like a Puerto Rico or Virgin Islands. I think the reality, though, is that, you know, going from over a century of being part of a constituent of the Kingdom of Denmark, an immediate change from being a constituent of one country to another country is going to be very politically difficult. And that's why I think a middle option is needed that satisfies the U.S. security concerns and also respects the sovereignty aspirations of the people of Greenland. That's what my proposal has been, something like a compact of free association, similar to what the U.S. offers to the Marshall Islands, Palau, Micronesia in the Pacific. Essentially, what this is Greenland would be a sovereign, independent country. It could be a UN member. It would have an independent foreign policy. It would operate the way that countries operate across all, you know, spheres, what the difference here would be is there would be a treaty that the United States would not just be obligated to defend Greenland, but would have unrestricted access to Greenland's airspace, water, land for defense purposes. And the United States would have the right of denial to deny any other power similar access. It would take away the one aspect of sovereignty that would be impinged upon would be in the area of defense, and really, which is the area in which the United States has our concerns. Other than that, I think full sovereignty for the people of Greenland is fantastic, and we should applaud that and celebrate and do everything we can to protect that, which is what the compacts would do. And there's an economic component as well. And I think there's actually some interesting parallels between how the U.S. state of Alaska, going back to when it was in the early days of statehood, how the people of Alaska were given a stake in the production of their own natural resources. They have something called the Alaska Permanent Fund, which creates a dividend where every Alaskan benefits from the fossil fuel reserve production of those resources as part of a compact development package where the U.S. would economically incentivize our friends in Greenland to enter into and stay in that compact. I would advocate for establishing some sort of permanent fund where essentially a universal basic income, as anathema as that may be to many of us on this call. But in this context, I think it makes sense where the resources that we would develop, critical minerals, copper, things that are natural resources that are in abundance in Greenland, we would take a significant chunk of the proceeds of those resources and distribute them as a dividend to the Greenlandic people. I think that would be a major part of any package that we would have to put together to get to a compact of free association.
Now over to you, Dr. Shepherd.
I think those are excellent ideas, but I would disagree with them slightly, because my perspective is really from the other side of the equation. So the perspective of international law, rather than departing from the perspective of the United States in this case. And I think from the perspective of international law, we really have to push for perhaps this idea that, as I said, this idea of external self-determination. So in this sense, Greenland or the Greenlandic independence needs to be front and center of any answer. And I think this goes back to the policy document Mr. Gray talked about from last year from the Greenlandic government on how to engage on a foreign policy level. And there's this sentence in this policy document of nothing about us without us. And I think that's really at the core of how the United States needs to engage Greenland, but also at the core of how we need to think about the matter. So we need to think about the matter from the perspective of Greenland itself, and whether Greenland itself would be able to enter into any sort of agreements with any sort of actors after its independence would remain Greenlandic or Greenland's choice. And I think that's really something that we need to think about as well, that independence in this sense means that Greenland could enter into a treaty with any actor that chooses so. And I think the United States here in this sense needs to make a case of why, for example, an agreement like Mr. Gray was talking about is important not only to the United States, but to Greenland as well. And perhaps tone down the language of acquisition or even the language of associating with the United States through statehood or through an Alaskan model, for example. I think this perhaps needs to foreground this argument of international law and respect for international law. I think, for example, acquisition in this sense would also mean potentially a restructure of the normative architecture of international law as we've come to know it, especially that it has the potential to destabilize a NATO partner in the sense of Denmark as well, and also I think this would not be the first time the U.S. acts in violation of its international legal obligation, at any state do or any state does to some extent. But this really, I think, from the perspective of international law, we really need to have at the core of the conversation the principle of self-determination. And if we lead with this principle of self-determination, which is a customary principle of international law, then it makes more sense to engage with Greenland on the one-to-one basis, rather than seeing just Greenland as part of this broader scheme of U.S. interests in the region. Greenland has its own priorities that should also be reflected in any agreement that that comes after independence, if Greenland chooses so. And I think the "if Greenland chooses so" is really what we need to focus on in this matter.
I want to take some questions from the audience before we wrap up. So I'll start with Mr. Gray. One question from the audience that I think you'd be best to answer was, what can the U.S. do now under the current treaty alignment to expand the security footprint in Greenland before any independence vote comes from the Greenlanders?
A couple of things. We have rights that we don't exercise sufficiently under the existing treaty. We watch the U.S. presence, military presence on the island decrease rapidly, which is negligent, given that the Arctic is becoming more insecure and more of an arena for geopolitical competition. So, I mean, I would like to see. And look, if you talk to senior officials in Copenhagen, they will tell you we have never once, the joint committee that makes these decisions, we have never rejected any American request for additional security, additional U.S. assets or additional U.S. requests. We've never rejected it. And we would frankly welcome additional U.S. requests in a number of areas. So I think we need the president. President Trump had a very aggressive Arctic strategy in his first term. I think you're going to see something similar, but expanded in this term. I think the U.S. needs to make a good faith effort to work with our Danish friends to put forward, and with the Greenlanders themselves, of course, to put forward some proposals of how we can strengthen the defense of Greenland right now. So in practice, what does that mean? I would like to see the U.S. Coast Guard playing a much more aggressive role defending the sovereignty around the coast of Greenland. This is environmental patrols. This is counter illegal fishing. This is all sorts of things that we can do that are both public goods, but also have important security implications as well. I think the space base that we have there that the vice president just visited, that is a tremendous national asset. It's our northernmost military installation. I think there's a lot more the Space Force would like to do, and we should make that a priority. And frankly, I think we should have a conversation about returning anti-submarine aircraft to Greenland, which were used throughout the Cold War to monitor for Russian subs. That's a similar concern that we have today, and I think we should use that. The final thing is, we should be encouraging, and I know we are, we should be encouraging our Danish friends to spend more on defense and to work jointly with us to have additional Arctic assets as well. And also to increase Greenlandic indigenous capacity and grow a cadre of Greenlanders who have security training and security skills to be prepared to play a significant role in their own defense and security going forward. So there's a lot we can do together in a trilateral way in the years ahead.
And one question from the audience for Dr. Schuffer. Given Greenland's population and small economy, I was hoping you could talk about their ability to economically sustain or survive independent sovereignty.
That's a very good question. So, as I said, or as I alluded to, there's a block grant from Copenhagen, which is about $600 million US dollars at the moment. And in the Self-Governed Act, there's also a specific provision that once the annual mining and oil revenues exceeds something like 75 million Danish kroner, which, to give the equivalent, $600 million US dollars is around 4 billion Danish kroner. So you can make the math for yourself here. Then Copenhagen will start reducing the subsidy here. So there are potential avenues here that Greenland is trying to diversify its economy. The previous government, so the government that were just before April this year, was very much against mining and against resource development, or at least put on hold to some of the key resource development in Greenland. But there are other political parties in Greenland looking into developing uranium, for example, or rare earth minerals in Greenland as well, which has been quite key to the Greenlandic economic potential in this sense as well. The other big sector here, whether Greenland is a small population doesn't really matter in this sense, is fisheries and fishing in this context. And we don't, it's not traditional fishing in the sense that we can picture, for example, small scale fishing. It is actually industrialized fishing on a scale that feeds some of the markets in Europe and also in China as well. So there are some actually big economic opportunities that Greenland, the Greenlandic parliament and the Greenlandic government is trying to develop a bit further, mainly here, I think, natural resource exploitation.
Thank you very much. I see we're running a little short on time, so I want to thank both of our guests for being here, and I'll turn things back over to Caroline.
Great. Thank you so much, Nitin. Yes, I just want to echo you and say on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you to our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.